This is the Product Management Leaders Podcast, in which you hear from some of the top PM leaders about their real-world strategies and tactics for building world-class products. It's sponsored by Vox Implant, the leading serverless communications platform and no-code drag-and-drop contact center solution. Vox Implant enables product leaders and developers to integrate communications into their products, such as embedding voice, video, SMS, in-app chat, and natural language processing. Join over 30,000 businesses trusting Vox Implant. Now, let's jump into the show. Hey, it's Grant Duncan, your host. Our guest today is Narayan Narasolahi, the SVP of Product Management at T0, a leader in blockchain technology for capital markets, and he was previously a VP at Overstock. He has a wide variety of experience ranging from being a PM, marketer, and even a lawyer. So let's get into the discussion. Welcome to the Product Management Leaders Podcast. Today we have Narayan Narasolahi on our show from T0, and I am Grant Duncan, your host. So to start us off, can you share a little bit about your role and what the company does? And I hope I got your name right.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. So what we do, so I work for T0 Group, I guess is our technical, like legal name, but everyone just calls us T0. My role there is I'm a senior vice president of product development. I'm one of two VPs on the product side there, which I guess is the focus of this podcast. So what T0 does, we are a blockchain company. Our initial focus was entirely on securities trading on the blockchain. So most people, I think, even a lot of the regulators have said that the future of, you know, securities trading is going to be on the blockchain. It brings some unique benefits to that. In particular, like right now, if you're, you know, on any broker and you buy an Apple stock, let's say, it takes a couple days for the trade to actually settle. And it's because different parties have to do different roles. And the unique thing the blockchain can bring to that is even though different parties have to do different roles, with smart contract tech, they could all do that at the same time. So one of like the early kind of slogans of our company is that the trade is the settlement. So the trade and the settlement happen at the same time. For most people, you know, who are kind of lay people, that is kind of meaningless. But really, it does cause a lot of problems in the financial system. I mean, part of what happened with GameStop, like the GameStop fiasco, where the price, you know, went
up.
Yeah,
I was thinking about meme stocks when you were talking.
Yeah. So that, like, where it just spiked and like the value of GameStop went from what, like, $20 to $350 overnight almost. And then Robinhood, which was one of the biggest platforms that was trading it at the time, had to turn off trading. The main reason for that is actually the delay in the settlement, which is kind of weird. Like, so banks will essentially assume that you're going to cover the cost, but it takes 2 days for it to actually happen. So you end up borrowing all the action that happens within those 2 days, and they just couldn't afford to pay for it, so they had to turn off trading. Yeah, so that's the problem we're trying to solve. Our goal, I mean, if you look at our products, it looks a little different than what I described. We have really two parts to our business. There's the T0 Markets, which is our registered broker-dealer. That's where you can go right now and buy. We have three digital securities that are trading. Overstock's OSTKO, which was paid out as a dividend, our own coin, which is called TZROP, and then we have Aspen Digital, which is actually a Ritz-Carlton in Colorado. We have a lot more that are coming this year, but it's a fully licensed U.S. broker-dealer. And then on the other side, we have T0 Crypto, is what it's called, which is more what I think the layperson would think of a crypto business. It's, you know, it's a platform you can get on and buy and sell cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, you know, Litecoin, Ether, all those things. And the goal from the product perspective, which I mean, bringing it back to product, is that we have two different and distinct entities that we have to bring together, which normally would be pretty easy, but with the regulations around it, it's a little more complicated. Yeah, one is markets is regulated by FINRA, And T0 crypto is regulated by banking laws, federal and state banking laws. So just bringing those together is a little harder than it should be, I would say.
Wow. Yeah. I imagine that adds a lot of complexity to your product decisions. Mm-hmm. So with T0 being in the blockchain and crypto space, that's, I imagine, something maybe difficult to explain. How do you talk about what you do to family or non-tech people? Yeah. If they ask, what do you do for a living?
I actually love that question. It's one of the challenges. I think, so my history is, I think, a little unique for a product person. I actually have a law degree, and I was a practicing lawyer for years before I switched over to the tech side. And so when I talk to my family, in particular, my mom and my dad, I mean, they're like, why aren't you being a lawyer? Yeah. and I have to try to explain what the hell I'm trying to do with my life. But really, with blockchain, I mean, it's never worthwhile to get into the weeds of how it works. And I actually think this is a good perspective to take from a product, like when you're defining requirements, especially, is think about it from what the user can get out of it. And like, how do you explain to your mom what the intrinsic value of Bitcoin is, or what, how do you explain to your mom what a blockchain backed security is, and how T0 can really help improve the world, really? And I mean, the best way I can ever describe it to them is to talk about the problems that exist in those systems. So the monetary system for cryptocurrencies, or the securities markets, Wall Street, what are the problems with Wall Street in general? And then say, our company is trying to use technology to solve that. And you don't really have to go much further than that. But, if I talk about it in just from, not problem or what we're trying to solve oriented, it never makes sense to them. But, everyone understands that there's issues on Wall Street. Everyone understands that there's issues with monetary policy. So there, that's the problem. We think this technology can solve it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So can you share a little bit more about T0 and your team? How many people are in your team, and how do you have it structured?
Yeah. So, it changes a lot. We actually have a very fluid company, which I think is a good practice, because, it gives you more flexibility and a much bigger ability to shift as priorities change. So we alternate what engineers work on. But if you get down to it, right now, I have three engineering teams. So one that's entirely focused on T0 crypto, so trading of cryptocurrencies, and then two of the teams that are focused on the markets and securities trading side. And again, like I said a little bit earlier, there's two VPs, that report to the chief product at T0. He manages quite a few teams, about the same number as well. With the nature of this business and kind of, we're not, I mean, we've been around for a few years. T0's, 5 years, a little more than 5 years old. So we're not exactly like early stage startup, but we still act like a startup. So you end up wearing a lot of hats. So I also manage, I have three dev teams. I have two full-time product managers. I also have a customer service team. So the people who actually answer the phone reports up through me right now, which doesn't seem intuitive, but that's our best connection to our customer and the pain points. So we decided to put it under product rather than keeping it, under the traditional business side. That's on the crypto side. On the broker dealer side, it's against the law for them to report to me, because they have to be licensed and I would have to be licensed too. But so I have that. And then in a previous life, I was a marketing executive. So I also have the marketing team report to me, which, right now it's a humble team. So it's not like a huge, if we had, marketing at scale, then there's no way I could handle all that. But right now I have a really great manager under me. So it's pretty hands off. It's just a little advice here and there.
Wow. Yeah, that's a That's a lot of people to manage and think about even, you know, how to create a culture among all those people.
Yeah.
I'm particularly interested about having customer support report under you, as that's not as common. Can you share a little bit more about what those interactions for the customer support team looks like with the product and engineers?
Yeah, it actually works out a lot better than I thought it would. So again, I mean, it all comes down to having strong leaders under you. If I had to like do day-to-day management on it, I wouldn't get anything done ever. But, you know, we have a strong director under me that manages the day-to-day customer support issues. But the value of it is it really closes the feedback loop. I think, you know, a lot of product people, and this is like one of the mantras that you'll hear everyone say is, you know, you do what's best for the customer, or you have to interact with your customer. And they do these focus groups, or, you know, they do demos, they try A/B testing. But like the biggest improvement, and I've done all that, and, you know, you get a lot. I mean, I'm not saying it's valueless, you know, it's very valuable, but like day-to-day knowing like what are people complaining about. Like, I think some of the best enhancements we've made have been because of that, a direct result. And not necessarily, I mean, it's like we've never had a customer call in and say, hey, you know, you need to add this, like you need to integrate with this company, which because they're going to provide a more seamless onboarding experience. It's not like those kinds of bigger projects, but it's these like little tiny tweaks that you can make that really makes a difference. And for me, those are like some of the things that are the greatest things you can do as a product manager or in a product org, something that takes minimal dev effort but has maximum impact for the user, which is great.
Yeah, those are great examples. Kind of reminds me of like, you know, just trying to find those quick wins. Mm-hmm. When you started at T0, were there any big aha moments or like learnings you didn't expect or quick wins you were able to find to add value in the beginning?
I would say yes. So T0, because it's in a highly regulated industry, was kind of had two big phases. One was, you know, really building the heavily regulated parts. And I was kind of introduced when they were already started and building out the customer more, you know, like low level investor facing parts. So, you know, in addition to all of the investor facing products I've discussed, we also, anyone who has a security that wants to trade it can come to us. We'll create, you know, a representation of it on the blockchain and have it trading, you know, essentially the next day. So that's the side of the business that was being built out initially. I came in after they'd already started building out the more UX-centered and investor-facing products. And that's where I think I've had a lot of the big impacts. And another thing, I mean, T0, I mean, our executive, our senior executives are primarily product-focused and have experience there, which used to not be true. So I came in at a time where we could make that transition and, you know, the entire company realized it's a build phase. We quickly expanded the number of engineers and there was a lot of, you know, chaos in it. But oddly, I think like some of the wins I'm most proud of, I mean, there's the big ones, like we launched the app or successfully, actually we bought a company and we had to convert their app to our app and, you know, get the technologies. Like those were huge challenges and huge accomplishments to succeed. But the things I'm always happiest with, again, they tend to be much smaller. Like you do this little thing that you're just proud of. An example I can think of is, you know, we have, you know, our back office support and they have to deal with day-to-day issues. And honestly, I kind of went rogue and decided we really need a tool for them. And, you know, we're building all these really neat, sexy sounding products. And I'm like, I want to build an internal app that, you know, so they can update a customer's phone number without, you know, having to do a database deploy, like something like that, where, you know, I kind of hit it under the radar. It wasn't a huge project. I mean, if it was big, I of course would have to justify it to everyone, but built it and since it went live, you know, we keep adding more and more to that same app. And now it's kind of like a core part of our business. And you know, I think those are the things that I'm always happiest with. And the only benefit we really, like, if you distill down, like, what did that actually do? Did nothing for the customer, but it saves our engineers from having to do, you know, manual product support or production support. It saves them from having to, you know, get emails daily from a customer service agent and just all the distractions. So it just made us more efficient, I think. And those are the things I'm always happiest with. But I really can't attribute the change in culture to myself. It really, I came in at the time when the culture changed. Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, I'm sure you helped contribute to it.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you all acquired a company and integrated the app in. You think about the build versus buy decisions, maybe at T0 or in the past? Because I think, you know, a lot of PM leaders have to think about similar kinds of decisions.
Oh, that is an exceptional question. And I wish I had like the super straightforward answer that could resolve it for everyone, but it's always going to be a challenge. And I mean, the first thing I look at when I'm making those decisions, it's a cost benefit analysis. Like, how much time do you save by buying at what cost, you know? And when I think about that, it's not like if I did built it myself, it's 6 months and a dev team costs $1 million a year. So that would cost $500K. It's not like that. It's if we go with the buy option, how much could we be like a year from now? How much further along in our product roadmap would we be? How much value do we get out of, you know, saving ourselves this much dev and focusing on other things that are valuable but have to happen, you know, or this has to happen before that can. That's the way I start to look at it. But then there's always the, you know, everyone, like not everyone, I shouldn't speak in complete hyperbole, but, you know, most vendors that you talk to, it's when you talk like, how difficult is the integration? Oh, two lines of JavaScript. I don't know. Like, I thought it was like a joke that they all said the exact same thing, but a lot of people do think it's just two lines of JavaScript and you're integrated. And a lot of times you find that
live in production too, right?
Yeah. Oh, of course. No need for testing. But I mean, I've heard that so many times and been burned by that, you know, I always assume it'll be a lot more than, you know, some front end writes two lines of JavaScript and suddenly you have a new, you know, Q&A section on your product page. That's not realistic, but it's trying to dig into the, like, what is really the complexity of integration and what's the real complexity of integration to get full value. A lot of times you'll see a product that is amazing, has hundreds of features, and you talk about integration, but you realize you get a quarter of the things that you thought you would get. You can get them all, but you just have to put more time into it. Yeah, I've been burned by that many a time. I've decided to buy versus build and regret it. So it's a tough one. And the last thing is just how much control do you want of that part of your business? Like, how custom do you want whatever it is? Like, for our CS platform, we bought, you know, I'm not going to build a customer service platform from scratch. There's a million companies out there that do it. I don't need to have a high level of control. You know, people have figured out how to do it effectively and just buy it, you know. In other areas, like from a previous job, not at T0, but the Q&A section on a product page, we decided to buy and realized it was not the best choice.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's good insights. Thanks. So how do you go about the planning process, whether it's annual, quarterly, monthly?
I love this question. To be honest, if you kind of look at my evolution as a product manager, we'll say, not as an executive, not as anything, but just as a product manager, and everyone claims they're agile. You know, I've realized that word is completely meaningless. Like, I've never seen a product manager resume that doesn't say agile. And I've seen a billion different implementations of agile. So kind of...
That's a good hot take.
Yeah. And I think some people, agile is like minimal planning. Let's just start executing and then we'll learn as we go. And for other people, they're planning heavy and the agile, other agile PM will be like, oh, that's waterfall. That's not agile. And, you know, they're both wrong and they're both right. You know, I started off more on the former. You know, I just wanted to start building, go as quickly as possible. Very little planning. Like, I know I want this. Let's just figure out how to do it. And as we go, we'll write out more and more requirements. The further along I've come, I've realized more and more what the value of planning is. And I mean, it's a good and timely question, I think, because it's I'm about to launch kind of like an internal test on a new way to plan a project. And you know, we've tweaked it. We've tried so many different things at T0, but the new one that I'm going with, we've realized like one of the biggest disruptors to our productivity and, you know, our deploying in at the dates we give. You know, we're going to try to deliver by this day, and then you slip. Everyone slips. It's no big deal. But like, why? What are we doing wrong beforehand? And one of the big gaps we always had is communicating up exactly what up as in like to the all the way up to the CEO, what exactly we were planning to deliver and what we wanted to do as fast follows and what were going to be future enhancements. Like really those three areas, right? Those are the things that we always knew as product. You know, we try to cut scope and again, you know, trying to be agile, deliver as quickly as possible and enhance it, or trying to be like lean startup style, same exact discussion. But, you know, how many times, I can't explain how many times I've had a product that is so close to launch and the executive actually sees it for the first time, like end to end. And they're like, wait, why isn't this feature in? And they're like, oh, we agree. We're going to deploy that 3 weeks later. And they're like, no, absolutely not. It has to be there before we go live. And it just like, it just completely derails everything, it feels like. So, Right. So that's part of it is, you know, the in scope, out of scope, and out of scope is defined as, you know, fast follows versus future enhancements. Future enhancements are the things that it's no big deal. Fast follows is the dev team won't be working on a different project because they're going to continue to work on the same product, you know? So that's half of it. And then the other half, which I don't know if it's unique to like our heavily regulated business, but I think it's really compounded by the heavy regulation of the business. And that is for us, compliance tells us we have to do something or that we can't do something that we're planning to do. It's a nightmare, honestly. Like imagine building an onboarding experience for a retail company. You know, you want them to have a sign in with you. What do you ask for? Email, password, right? That's it. That's onboarding. We have to actually do, it's called KYC, which stands for Know Your Customer, but it's a federal requirement. And we have to verify their identity. So you have to get a driver's license. You have to, you know, do all of these checks. It's just painful how much it disrupts like a good user experience. I mean, it's a good idea. I mean, if they didn't have it, there'd be a lot of fraud and whatnot. But just managing that, we've gotten burned by that before too, where, you know, maybe they see the design, the legal and compliance team sees the design after dev has been underway for a while. And they're like, oh no, you can't do that. And, you know, you wasted a sprint of dev work on something that's not allowed. So that's part of the goal of this document is we just have like a questions and it's executive summary, just like layperson speak of what we need. And so that way legal before the designs, before anything can see what we're planning on doing and shut us down if need be. I mean, there's a few more sections, but it's not that interesting. But essentially, like, that's like, for me, planning before was, you know, writing a detailed requirements documents, making sure, you know, all the stakeholders were happy. But I realized that I always said I was doing that, but mostly I just wrote requirements, you know, like, one of our stakeholders is compliance. I would just tell them, like, hey, we're going to build this. I wouldn't actually go into the minutia of it. And if I give them the requirements document, but to them, it probably, one of my old bosses used to always say it was dolphin speak. Like, he could understand what the engineers were saying as much as he could understand a dolphin sometimes, because you get really technical in there. So just, I think there's some value. Well, I'll test this. It might not be true. So don't, I mean, talk to me in a couple months. I'll tell you if it worked or not. We're literally, like, doing it this week. We're doing our first project on this model. But I think that's the side of planning I never did before, which was having a summary that any idiot can read and understand exactly what you're doing. And you can get sign off from people, not like they sign off on the requirements document, which before they did, but again, they didn't understand it. So, but planning is hard. It really is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an interesting way to break it down. I imagine some of our listeners might try to incorporate your test and see if it works for them.
It might. But I mean, this might be an executive, you know, product management type philosophy, but really, I mean, the most important resource is our engineering, you know, bandwidth or throughput. And the more planning you do, the more you can make sure that that throughput is focused on the right things and are adding value to the company. And as far as, like, what a ground level PM should do is everything and anything they can to make sure their engineers don't get distracted from writing code. Yeah. If you're, you know, if your dev lead is creating the Jira tickets that represent your user stories or whatever model you use, that's a waste of time. Yeah, they're in there just typing your words out in a different, you know, platform. That's a waste of time. Yeah, the engineers should be writing code. I think it makes them happier and it makes your company more productive. But it ends up with the PM having to do a lot of busy work, but it's worthwhile in the long run.
Yeah, that makes sense. Since I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, I obviously have a lot of friends that are engineers, and a lot of them do talk about just wanting to code and not wanting to be in meetings. Like, they just don't enjoy it as much.
I just want to code. Yeah. That's one of the things I think COVID has really made worse is the number of meetings. You know, not having everyone together, you know, where you can just go ask a question. And I'm probably, like, one of the most annoying people for an engineer to work with, because I just screw around and I go distract them all the time. they even jokingly got these red buttons that would glow. And if they press the button, they're like, Darman, you're not allowed to ask us any questions. If the red button is on, we're working. But I mean, given that it has its downsides, but, like, if I had a simple question, I could just ask someone. You know, you try to do that on Slack, you try to do it on email, but having, like, a 5-minute conversation is the equivalent of an hour and a half on Slack, it feels like. And then, even though, you know, email and Slack are great tools, I mean, I can't imagine working without something that's the equivalent of both of those, at least. Great tools, but it's that task switching that I think has a high cost. Like, I could be in the zone working on a presentation. Let's say I'm an executive, so I don't do anything meaningful anymore. So I'm in PowerPoint doing super important work, but you know, I get a Slack message and I shift over. I look at that. And when I go back to the presentation, there's at least 5 minutes to actually get back into the flow of things. So, like, this 1 second message actually costs 5 minutes, which, I mean, it sounds like I'm, you know, being draconian about it, but you get 100 of those a day, that's 500 minutes. That's more than a day. Yeah. Like, it compounds and gets bad really quick. So, And then with like the meeting dilemma, which all of my engineers have said the same thing. I hate it. I hate going to meetings. I hate wasting my time. I just want to code. now, instead of just walking up to someone and asking a question, you schedule a 30-minute meeting. You bullshit for 5 minutes, and then you get into, oh, I don't know if I can swear, you bull crap for 5 minutes, and then you like actually start to get into the substance, and it's just bad. So we do, as a practice, just meeting grooming, just start getting rid of reoccurring meetings, which ones don't add value, which ones should be biweekly, which ones should never happen, who's on this meeting that really doesn't need to be there. And then the other thing, I tell it to all of my direct reports at least, is, you know, unless you know that like you have to be there, like the meeting is about something that you're directly related to, like no one will ever care that you missed a meeting. Like, when was the last time, you know, someone calls in sick and they're not at the meeting and you're like, oh my gosh, we can't have this meeting anymore because this one of 20 people here isn't there. So I encourage people just to decline meetings, especially reoccurring ones. If it's important, of course, attend, but if it's just like that meeting where you update everyone, that's a waste of time.
Yeah,
kind of sidetracked from product.
Interesting idea, though. Yeah. I imagine others. I've been doing something similar and thinking like, okay, who really needs to be at some meetings, and try to cut it down, because that's a great point.
Yeah, it really gets out of control very quickly.
Yeah,
everyone schedules reoccurring meetings, and no one ever cancels reoccurring meetings. At some point, there's going to be a problem. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So when you think about your teams, what are some of the core metrics that you are tracking?
That's a good one. So we do, we do two things. I probably should have mentioned this in the planning section before, but we use the OKR models. Oh my God, I can't remember what OKR stands for, which is...
Yeah, objectives and key results.
Objectives, key results.
Yeah.
There we go. There we go.
Yeah, we do. We use it too.
I got frozen on the spot. So of course, that's one of our, you know, metrics that we measure the teams by. And, you know, it's pretty cascading. I think we do a relatively good job about it, where, you know, the CEO or the company OKRs, I take a slice of that, and then my, you know, the people under me take a slice of that, along with some things that maybe are outside of it, but it's mostly working towards the same objective. So one of the things we measure, and we actually don't use it as like a performance review at all. I think that's a waste of OKRs, honestly, if you're doing that, because everyone will just sandbag and, you know, give the easiest things that they could possibly deliver. But we're more interested in, like, I've had quarters where I get like an 85% score at the end. We grade it on, you know, 0 to 100. How did you accomplish your key results? And I get these really high scores, and I'm like, oh, that's horrible. I messed something up in that quarter. I wasn't aggressive enough. I wasn't thinking big enough. And then I've honestly had a quarter where I got like 11%. And that was like, oh, I completely overshot the mark. And I mean, in that quarter, you know, something external that we weren't aware of came in and just ate up all of our time. Mm-hmm. So we didn't get to work on any of the things we planned. But both of those just mean that, you know, the way that we think we're working is different from the way we want to work. So then when you get down to like measuring your teams, it shouldn't be on, you know, the grade they get there, but how can you ensure that you're being, you know, both aggressive and, you know, as aggressive as possible, trying to deliver as much as possible while, you know, maintaining a quality of life, maybe. You know, the best way to get as much done as possible is everyone works 14 hours a day, glued to a computer, you know. But I think, you know, going back, it has to do with planning. And one of the things that we require with projects is, how are you measuring the success of the product after it goes live? Of course, analytics is the most basic thing in the world. And then the second half is, how are you measuring, you know, throughput and the actual development of that product? And, you know, I used to be very data-centric on the end results, which I still am. You'll never get away from that. But now the throughput side of it, I realize, is a lot more important. It's amazing how much time and effort is wasted on stupid things that don't add value, that just eat up time. So like, how do you measure that people are being as efficient as possible? And I think the only way to do that is to, have retrospectives and keep that as part of your, you know, sprint planning and retrospectives, because they're intangible numbers. I'm not going to look at like how many hours was this employee logged in, because that's creepy.
Yeah. Those are good overall ideas though. Mm-hmm. Can you share about how you manage stakeholder relationships? You know, a PM has to work with so many different groups. And even as you're mentioning, you have the compliance addition to it.
Yeah, that's hard, especially in big organizations. It gets really tricky. We've spent a lot of time like doing complete, ground up reorganizations of the entire company to try to deal with exactly that issue. So, that's why customer service reports to me that I mentioned earlier is because they were a stakeholder. They were getting ignored, by product. They were reporting up through compliance, I think. And so they were just this orphan child, and they would identify issues that no one would address because it just never bubbled up correctly. So I mentioned earlier that we're doing this like executive summary document. That's what I'm calling it, super creative name so far. I think that's a good start. I love, tools like Google Docs. Like I learned this weird lesson and maybe like 6 months ago is I would email someone to get an answer and I wouldn't get it. I would, I'd get like a fuzzy answer or let's schedule a meeting type answer. I tried all these approaches. I sent a Slack message and it wouldn't work. And this is on stakeholders. In our org, we use our tools and we use them well. Like I said earlier, we'd show them the requirements and say, are we missing anything? But it would be a link to a Confluence page. And I think just because it was Confluence, their head would blow up and they couldn't process it. So we started like, it's literally like copying and pasting it into a Google Doc. And then you hit the little plus button and at compliance, is this okay? And you would get a response like instantaneously. I don't know why. I don't know what the psychology of it is. I don't feign to know, but that's been a very effective tool in it. You always want them to be informed of what you're doing and understand what, the benefits and what their responsibilities will be in the world afterwards. But it's how do you effectively communicate that without wasting a lot of time, We used to do these like project kickoff meetings and there would be like 100 people that would be invited and someone would put together this great deck and they'd go through it like, this is exact. We're going to move this button up by 3 pixels and this is what we think we're going to get. And it ended up just being busy work. And this is like before COVID, people would be in the meeting, just screwing around on their laptop, completely not paying attention. So, the goal was to work with your stakeholders, but that was never the end result. But for some reason, I've had success with, we still do a summary, like this is what we're going to do. What are the risks? Here's what you guys need to do type, discussion meeting, maybe 30 minutes. But for some reason, just putting it in a Google Doc and then commenting it to them, it literally has saved me so much time. And again, I tell you, I'm in a compliance heavy area. So if I say, like, this is literally one of the conversations that it took me maybe 3 days to get an answer to, that I think in my new doing the comment in Google Docs, it would have taken me 10 minutes was, do we need to collect middle initial? Huh. That's it. Like one field. And I want as few fields as possible in onboarding. Right. Do we need middle? I don't have a middle name, so maybe I'm biased, but like, do we need to collect the middle initial? Like how important is that in onboarding? For me as a product person, the less is better, easier is better. But for compliance, it's a whole different story, but trying to like pull that information out of them is painful. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. That's cool to think about testing other forms of communication to engage each group in the way that, makes sense for them. And yeah. I'm sure, you know, when you think about the information needed to collect for you previously working at Overstock, you have that e-commerce mindset that, you know, you don't need a lot.
Exactly.
I'm sure it's a change.
I mean, it's just good practice. I think in MySpace specifically, not MySpace, the former app, but my work area.
You mean you don't still use your MySpace?
Oh, I do, man. You got to see the picture I have, the music that plays automatically. You'll love it. I'm curious what's there now. But like Robinhood is an amazing company. And the thing that they did that disrupted it, I mean, it's an app. Onboarding on an app is like the biggest nightmare in the world. Onboarding to a broker dealer on the app is a nightmare too. But things that like had become assumed to be absolute requirements by like compliance people in the broker dealer space, they didn't do. And they never got in trouble for it. And they were always successful in KYCing. So I think that's the argument I make with them more often than not is, well, these guys don't collect it. How do they get away with it? And, you know, they realize that there's the old strategy was collect as much as you can because there's zero risk. You know, the new world is you got to eat some risk. And then the other thing is they would keep, you know, like traditional compliance people, they would just keep adding additional things to the onboarding, and never remove anything. But technology advanced far enough where, I mean, the end goal is to identify the customer. Now you can do it with email history. Is it the same human being that logs in on Amazon as Nariman with that email that logs in on your app with that same email? So the technology advanced to make IDing a customer a lot more efficient, but the number of things they asked didn't get more efficient. So it's like these things that are just kind of hard-coded and, you know, use the cheesy Silicon Valley, the TV show term, like, we got to disrupt that. But I mean, that's really what they did is it's anytime anyone has been doing the same thing for a long time, you should question it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good quote there.
Yeah. A good, here's a really stupid story, but I think it's super valuable. There was an analytics team at a company I worked at that every week would get together this spreadsheet and send it out to all of the stakeholders on it. Every week, this person would go in, write the SQL script, and send it to everyone. It would take a person 2 full days to get it together. It would come out on Tuesday, and they'd start on it on Monday. And someone's like, wait, why do you do that? And they're like, well, that's what we do. We send them this data. And someone in their spare time wrote a script that would automate it. And then that person never again had to spend those 2 days pulling that together. He would just download the CSV at the beginning of the week and send it out on Monday. And that's like, it's something that team had done for 10 years. And one person who's like, why do we do it that way? Changed everything. Internal disruption.
Yeah, that's amazing. Scripting can be very helpful for internal processes as well. It's a great example.
Yeah.
Are there any other like key product management strategies that you'd want our listeners to hear before we wrap up?
I think the biggest like lesson I would have to product people, and I'm thinking of like, what do I do in my one-on-ones with product managers over the years? And there's like a couple things that I think make effective product managers and actually make effective employees. Number one is that they own their product. They like, even if they don't care, you could be working on the most banal and like boring, just horrible thing ever. But like, if you own it, own it. If someone tells you to do something that's different from what your priority list, you know, defend your priorities against it. I don't know how many times someone has come over the top, you know, over the top, like an executive says, work on this instead of this. And then later you regret it. You're like, why didn't I do what I originally had planned? Because you're the most familiar. So like fight for what you believe in. And then the second half of it, which kind of goes along with that, I think it does go hand in hand with ownership is, you know, every now and then just break the rules, like go rogue, do your own thing, try something completely crazy. Sometimes you can't, you know, tell your boss that you're doing it. Like that stupid little thing I built. like every now and then it's worthwhile to, you know, just go rogue. Everyone tells the product manager that, you know, you act like you're the CEO of your own business and this, you know, this is your domain. You don't get to act that way realistically in a company, but every now and then you should. Like it's usually people will tell you to act like you're the owner, but then they won't let you act like the owner. So every now and then, just do your own thing. Don't tell anyone. Your dev team will love it, by the way, because usually it's something that they've wanted to do forever and they haven't gotten the chance to. And just say, look, act like it's tech debt. Spend, you know, 20% of your time working on this project, but we'll be doing the bullshit that they told us to do. But let's do this too. So just like go rogue. It really, I mean, that's what made my career, is doing something I've shouldn't have been doing, but it proved to be valuable. And you know, that's how I showed my value. And if you think you're right about something and you have good reasons to think you're right and no one will let you do it, break the rules, like screw it. Yeah. If it doesn't work out, worst thing happens is you find another job, which there's plenty of right now. So, so yeah.
Yeah. Good so take.
I think that's it for me.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And if you could think of one other person that we should have on this podcast, who comes to mind that's another PM leader?
Oh, man. I knew you were going to ask this, and I came up with nothing good, by the way, as an answer to it. There's a gentleman named Michael Lovelady. I can help you connect to him. He is crazy, like no other way to describe him. He's he's equally brilliant and horrible, but he is one of the smartest and most product-centered people I know. He would be worthwhile. I think he just consults now.
Okay. Michael, we'd love to have you on if you're listening. Thanks so much for your time today, Nariman. Great talking to you.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, bye.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast, and thanks to our sponsor, Vox Implant, as well. If you're looking into how to improve your communication and customer engagement, check them out. Lastly, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and tell your friends so that others can find it more easily. Have a great day, and feel free to reach out to me, Grant Duncan, if you have any questions you want asked in our next episode.